You guys, I am so excited. The countdown is on. We only have a few more days until we're off to Amherst, Massachusetts, and a visit to the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art. Are you guys as excited as I am?
Like pee my pants type of excited. And I can't believe this is happening because way back when this episode we're about to encore first dropped, Kristen was telling us about the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art. And she's like, you guys, we have to go there. And we were, Carolyn, remember you and I are like, oh my God, that's like a dream come true for us. But kind of in my head thinking, but it'll never happen. Like, I'm never going to go all the way to Massachusetts just for this. Now it's like double. I would have just gone to go to the museum, but to see the Free to Be exhibit as well. Mm.
It's a great example of how things are meant to be. Because you had that thought that, like, how am I going to get there? Why would I go to this tiny museum in the middle of nowhere? For what reason would I do this? Well, how about if they reach out to you and invite you? To come be guests at their Free to Be You and Me exhibit. It just, everything happens for a reason.
And we've learned over and over and over again in the past 4.5 years. And probably we were learning this for decades. We just didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. To trust in timing.
Just trust.
To just keep being authentic and trust in timing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're right. I don't know that we've acknowledged that enough, that they did reach out to us. And we, of course, are so humbled and grateful for them for thinking of us to come on out and
And the fact that we have so many listeners that are joining us, and this happened earlier on in our adventure of podcasting, we might not have had as many people, if any, that wanted to come hang out with us.
Yes, good point.
So it's not too late if you're listening to this before April the 6th of 2025, because that's when we'll be headed there and we'll be meeting up with some listeners. We're so excited about that. So Kristen, I know you have gone, like Michelle just said, a few times. What do Michelle and I need to expect?
How do we prepare ourselves, Kristen?
How do I find myself at this little museum in the middle of the Berkshires? It's a small museum in the middle of a beautiful countryside with the most beautiful art from your favorite books is what this museum is. And the first time I went was on a road trip traveling from Minnesota to New Hampshire when we were moving to New Hampshire. And I think I was maybe trying to slow down the trip a little bit. I was a little bit in denial about having to move. And so this was my opportunity to pull over, basically, and see this. So Eric Carle, as you all know, is the author of The Very Hungry Caterpillar and many, 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 many books. I have to tell you, that little caterpillar and all of the food that the caterpillar eats through, that becomes the theme of everything on every wall, on all of the signage. There's a butterfly where there's a big photo op. It just is such a beautiful place to set yourself down. And it's a Gen X bonanza because this is a museum about the history of picture book art. And so much of what is important about the world of picture books came from our era, came from the books that we read when we were little, especially books from the 60s. We read so many books from the 60s when we were little, not just Eric Carle, but also Ezra Jack Keats, The Snowy Day, A Whistle for Willie. Can't you see those pictures in your mind?
Well, I was just going to say that we are so lucky because that art is super distinctive and
so iconic. Yeah.
And, you know, like many other things that we got to enjoy in our generation, it's just the best.
It really is the best. It's so distinct. And I have yet to feel an era. And remember, I'm a children's librarian, so I've gone through all these different eras of picture books. The art from this era is my favorite art by far. And when you go to a museum like this, you see this not just as stuff from a book, but it really is art. And you will leave there wanting to put it on your walls.
I bet I will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I bet literally I will. Did I ever tell you all about when my older daughter, she was working in the Florida Keys at this really cute little coffee shop. And she was in there one time and she was, you know, making the, I don't know, paninis or whatever. And she said there was this little old man in the, you know, at one of the tables. And her coworkers was like, do you know who that is? And she's like, no. And she said, that's Eric Carle.
What?
And of course, my daughter knew immediately who Eric Carle was. Right. And she's like, what? Mm-hmm. And then the coworker's like, yeah, he comes in all the time. And she pointed on the wall. And sure enough, they have framed picture signed of the very hungry caterpillar. And she said he was so cute. And he lived in the near in the Florida Keys. I don't know how far, but he came to that coffee shop all the time. And she said she was a little starstruck, obviously.
Of course.
And she's like, he was so old. And I was like, well, he was, because then he died only like, we should look that up. But it was only a year or two later at a very old age. But isn't that kind of a cool brush with fame?
Wow, yes.
And I'm so happy that he's famous. Look at who this celebrity is. A little old man who drew a caterpillar. And this is our celebrity. That makes me feel so good that not just your young daughter, Gen Z. Wait, is she millennial? She's millennial.
She's millennial. But, yeah. She's like right on the cusp. And yes, he did die. And he was 91.
Yeah.
And he would have died just about a year and a half later, because he died May 23rd of 2021. And this would have been in like January of 2020.
And all those kids that she worked with, he was a celebrity to them too.
Absolutely. Yes.
What a beautiful person to be a celebrity.
What a legacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is amazing. And also what I think of when I'm going to enter this museum is this visceral response, because it's going to be obviously the books that I grew up reading and just studying those illustrations, but it's also the books that I have memories with my children reading. And so, you know, Maggie and Andrew and Grace all know who Eric Carle is. And that is going to be one of those, again, like, what did we call it? Like a Manilode moment almost. Uh-huh. It's going to even be triple of that, because it's going to be me now just, oh my gosh. It's going to be little kid Carolyn looking at this. It's going to be mom Carolyn when she was reading these books to her kids. It is going to be a triple whammy. And I am so excited to visit.
You know what's interesting is I have way more memories of Eric Carle picture books, reading them to my children, than I do as having them read to me or seeing them as a child. I mean, yes, The Very Hungry Caterpillar was huge in our house when my girls were little, but it was Brown Bear, What Do You See? That was the most requested book. And then that would just translate to anytime we'd go to the zoo or anything, you know, the girls would be repeating it. So to me, Carolyn, to your point, it's almost Eric Carle to me is almost more memorable for my motherhood, my own motherhood, than when I was a child. But the entire museum, I'm sure, will be Husker Du me with other illustrations from when I was a child.
And do you want to know something crazy, Michelle?
What?
Brown Bear, Brown Bear, What Do You See? Was briefly banned in 2010 by the Texas State Board of Education.
What?
Mm-hmm. I know.
What's wrong with bears? What's wrong with bears now?
I know. You would think, what's wrong with bears? Well, nothing's wrong with the bears. They thought something was wrong with the author. Okay? The author we know is Bill Martin Jr. Well, the Texas State Board of Education, they don't, I guess, like to do their research. Who knows? Not calling them out here. But they mixed up Bill Martin Jr. with another author named Bill Martin, who actually wrote an adult book called Ethical Marxism, The Categorical Imperative of Liberation. And so as a result of that confusion, the Board of Education briefly removed the children's book from the public school curriculum.
Okay.
You
I
guys.
Just, I have so many things to say right now.
I'm sure
the
you
Board
do.
Of Education.
Exactly.
And yet these people are not educated enough to do the research to find out who the hell the person even is?
Exactly. It defies logic. It's just befuddling. I can't even. Yes. I mean, it wasn't because like you, Michelle, I was like, bears? I know the story by heart practically. I've read it so many times. I'm going through, what on earth?
Yeah.
And then I read this and I just think, can you get any dumber or lazier? I'm sorry. That's just lazy.
You know, it's like, I love Kristen's expression from a few episodes ago. It's the human equivalent of the facepalm emoji.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
That's all you can do anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, you know.
Well, and whatever. You know what else? This is also kind of sad when you think of picture books and Eric Carle. He had another book. So Eric Carle obviously illustrated Brown Bear.
Mm-hmm.
So Eric Carle also wrote and illustrated a book called Draw Me a Star. Okay. This book is banned. Let me tell you, to this day, okay? So it begins with the artist Eric Carle drawing a star, and the star asks him to draw a sun and eventually a woman and a man, and the artist draws a handsome couple. Well, in his classic style, you know, the collage style, the couple is not clothed, okay? But, not, you know, it's Eric Carle, people, okay? And for children that lived in the school districts in Florida, Iowa, and Texas, the boards of education thought, no, this book has not to be included into our curriculum at all. So since 2021, other schools have also joined in, and some of them have added paper clothes. I don't even know how you do this. Is this like you permanently glue with like super glue clothes on them? I don't know. How awful is that? But you guys, here is the irony to all of this, okay? Because you might not realize that Erich Karl actually grew up in Nazi Germany. His mm-hmm. father was drafted into the army and was actually taken prison by the Soviets. And Karl himself actually dug trenches, okay? So, I mean, he knows firsthand what Nazi Germany is like, what they are doing to books and art and all of that. His art teacher, actually, who told him that Hitler was banning some of the major kind of impressionist, expressionist artists, burning those pieces of art. And so that is kind of the inspiration that he went into his art career with, that he was going to do this expressive, impressionistic kind of art that really spoke. And for him, Erich Karl, beloved children's book illustrator, to have one of his books in our world today banned just breaks my heart.
You know, just to give people an idea of what the illustration is, it looks like Mommy and Daddy, and all of these kids see Mommy and Daddy naked, and it's not even as detailed as what you see in person. It's not detailed at all. It just, to a child, to a young child, a naked Mommy and Daddy is just what they see in their house.
Exactly. And, you know, I love this quote from an NPR article talking about Erich Karl's work and being banned. The article says, "What Karl wasn't allowed to see growing up in Germany spurred a life of art. Perhaps the next generation in Florida, Iowa, and Texas will be inspired in the same way when they see work like Karl's that they've been shielded from."
Wow.
I know. How powerful is that? Mm-hmm.
And this is such good, this little bit of history that you've given us about Erich Karl is really great. And I want to let people know who are joining us at the museum that there is a movie about Erich Karl that you can see. It's just like a 10-minute long movie or something that makes sure not to miss this movie if you visit the museum. Even if you're not coming to see us, if you get to go to this museum at some point, make sure to catch that movie because it will tell you everything you know about being an artistic person and what it means to the children of the world.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful.
Well, to flip it to happy thoughts and happy news, I'm just so excited to be at the museum in a couple of weeks with our listener friends and with the people at the museum just to celebrate this and to just be with people who appreciate it and who get it, who get the impact of his, you know, his artistry, really, and the impact it's had for decades on so many.
And will continue to do so for generations because this museum is preserving not just his work, but so many important people's work.
That's what's going to be so incredible. And I can't begin to describe to you guys how excited I am to have this communal experience. So when I, you know, turn a corner and see some piece of art from a book, it's not just going to be me inside going, oh, I'm going to be able to turn to
you can
one of
us.
You guys or one of our followers
and go, listeners.
You guys, look at that. I think it's going to be powerful to be with others who get as much joy out of this as we do. So we're looking forward to that so much.
Looking so forward. Kristen, do they have picture books for sale in their museum gift shop?
Only do they have picture books for sale, the gift shop, you could go just for the gift shop alone.
So should I bring an extra bag to check?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep, bring an extra bag. There, of course, the selection of picture books is outstanding. That alone will take all day just to go through. And then they have all that great merch from, if you guys know the company Out of Print, they will get copyrighted images from picture books and literature that we grew up with. And they put it on socks and T-shirts and lunch boxes.
And
they have tons of art supplies. I mean, it is just, it's such a creative place.
Yeah. Maybe two bags, Michelle. Maybe you need to bring two extra bags. Because don't forget, there's going to be the Free to Be You and Me merch
That's right. There is.
My heart's already beating a little
fast. They were so kind to send us T-shirts, too. And I love my T-shirt. We're wearing those, right, girls?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes, we're 100%. Wearing them. Yes.
And we encourage you, if you're coming to meet us, get a T-shirt.
Yes.
We want to be matchy-matchy with you.
Go on their website. You can order that.
You could get a day of too. Just walk in.
You can just go in and get it and then put it on. We'll do our picture at the very end so that we can. Mm-hmm. And so listeners, be on the lookout for that. And I know there's a lot of you listening right now who are like, this is horrible. I wish I could go or I wish I lived closer. We do too. We really do. But understand that we feel you guys, we feel your excitement for these times we're able to have these meetups, and we'll be thinking of all of you when we're there.
Yes, we for sure will. So listeners, today we will be revisiting our love of picture books as we prepare for our trip to the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art. So please enjoy episode 31, our encore of Where the Wild Books Are.
I'm Lowly Worm. God, I love that little worm.
I love that little worm.
And why did he have a little fedora on with the little feather? Isn't that funny that he chose to put a little hat?
He was fancy.
Yeah. Hello world, is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation whose text messages were handwritten on paper, torn from Mead spiral-bound notebooks, and folded into intricate triangles.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall Will and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we will be saving our very first books, the ones we read before we could read, with a very special book club devoted to our favorite picture books.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
On my 51st birthday, I posted this message on Instagram. If you have a picture book that still walks around with you in your heart, then you'll understand why I flew to Massachusetts and drove to a tiny town through harrowing Boston traffic to spend 1 hour in a museum that held the original drawings for one of my favorite picture books of all time. Then I included a picture of the book and the drawings and the 3D life-sized replica of the book's main character. And the response surprised me. It was swift and heartfelt. Grown men and women, people who are not even teachers or librarians, swooning over my book, a book they hadn't read since kindergarten. And they were commenting things like, I gasped when I saw this post. Oh, be still my heart. Can you touch it? Please say yes. Ugh, you are killing me. I am in love with this book and your field trip. Very special book to me. Always loved this book and searched hard so I could find and read to my kids. And my favorite comment, this book is the reason I have a degree in urban geography from the University of Minnesota. It was a testament to how these childhood experiences can affect us for the rest of our lives. And at the end of this episode, I'll tell you which book that was.
Ooh. I know what book it is. Spoiler, I'm not going to say because it's one of my very favorite picture books as well. I feel like I could have written all of those comments on Instagram.
And it was kind of a wild hair. Like I had done a big deal for my 50th birthday and 51 was kind of falling flat. And I saw an advertisement for this exhibit and I was like, hey, you guys, I'm getting on a plane. And my family just thought I was crazy. But the fact that people responded that way really told me that, wow, this is a big deal. It's not just for me. And so almost universally, the picture book is pretty much every human being's first exposure to reading. And you guys are readers like me. I know you have memories of those first books. Where did your first picture book memories come from? Was it your mom? Was it a teacher? Was it a library? How do these memories come up for you?
Well, I know for me, definitely my mom is interwoven in all of them. But I distinctly remember getting my picture books in the mail. So we were members of two book clubs that occurred during the 1970s. One was called Parents Magazine Press, and the other was the Weekly Reader Book Club. And so each month, a thin cardboard box would arrive in the mail, and usually it would end up on my kitchen table. My mom would put it there. And the delight I would feel when I walked into the kitchen and saw that telltale box on the kitchen table was, it was magical. It really was magical. Were you guys members of any of those book clubs? Do you remember those?
I don't know if we were. I don't have that memory. Now that you're saying that about the box, though, did it have a little thing you ripped off, almost like perforated? Then we been members. The reason I'm saying that is because all of my favorite picture books from childhood And most of the ones that I still have are the Parents Magazine press books. Never Tease Isn't a Weasel and Miss Twiggly's Treehouse and Miss Susie, and all of those books are those Parents Magazine press books. So it wasn't until you brought this up and were telling this to us the other day, Carolyn, that I thought, oh, me too. And a lot of our society members have also chimed in and said that they remember very specifically the Parents Magazine press books as well.
Well, I want to say that upon my research, I realized the only way you could have read these books was if you were a member of the book club.
Oh, really?
Maybe not read them, but that was the only way you could get them. They were not and are still not available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble unless you're buying something from a used bookstore. So they were only published through Parents Magazine Press, and I haven't found any available in any public libraries even now. And I realized we didn't have Barnes & Noble.
No.
We didn't have, like, in the suburbs, at least, corner bookstores or places to go besides the library to really get a lot of children's books. So this was kind of the way to get them for any families who wanted to have a regular book collection in their home.
For me, my earliest memories with picture books definitely come from home. We always had tons of books in our house. My mom was a big reader and a lover of books. And so I grew up with a really good role model for reading. And I don't have vivid memories of my mom reading aloud to us, but I know for certain that she did. But between me and my older sister, we had and still have shelves full of these books, of you know, picture books. And I was an early reader. So sitting with a stack of books, either reading or just flipping through the pages over and over again, is something I did daily. And for me, I think it's the characters. They're like old friends. Like, as you guys, you know, I've talked a lot about moving, and we've talked about all of us moving and how our celebrity crushes or favorite songs could move with us. And that's how my books and the character friends in my books were too. And these characters and these books were my constant. Like, they went with me wherever I went, and their stories stayed the same when mine was changing all the time.
Oh, that's really sweet. That is really sweet. And you know, they actually have evidence that people who grew up in homes that were slightly messy become better readers. And the reason that is that a lot of the mess comes from stacks of books just laying around your house. And that kind of that's true for me too. We had stacks of reading material everywhere, and that becomes a part of your daily ritual. And it starts to make memories, like you said, Michelle, because you had some instability and these books were and these characters were a constant for you. But these are even more important memories because they come about when we cannot read, at least at the beginning. We cannot read, and the story has to be communicated through artwork. We have to be able to glean the story just by looking at the pictures, and possibly done with the aid of a loving adult, right? So these images get stored in our brains along with feelings. It's not just concrete words. It comes along with feelings, possibly feelings of love and security and comfort, because you might have been sharing that with the loving adult who's sharing the words with you. So it's often and ideally a bonding experience with someone that you love. Even if your parents didn't read to you, maybe that important person was an older sibling, or maybe it was a teacher that you loved, or maybe it was your librarian at story time. And I can tell you, as the story time librarian, I had a lot of two-year-olds falling in love with me. I had stories of parents would come to story time and they would talk about their children saying, waking up from their nap and saying, will you take me to Kristen? Because they have this love and comfort from this constant adult, right?
That's right. And I want to interject that there was nothing like the way a librarian could read a picture book or a book. I mean, that is an art in and of itself that I would try and imitate. You know, I would sit on my little chair with my stuffed animals in front of me and hold it. And was I the one who would open and read to the side? You know, that was really hard.
Oh, yes.
I would read like that to my stuffed animals and my dolls all the time. Can I tell you guys a little story? It's actually thanks to children's picture books is the entire reason I became an elementary school teacher.
Oh, my God.
I wanted to be a newscaster, but I didn't want to be on the news. I wanted to be Mary Hart. Like, I wanted to be an entertainment. Obviously, I wanted to be a red carpet interviewer. And so I was enrolled in the Walter Cronkite School of Telecommunications at Arizona State University. And then one day, One of my sorority sisters was walking in and she had a giant stack of children's picture books, like almost so tall she could barely carry it. And I remember her name is Sarah. And I said, oh my God, like I was just instantly like, I just instantly fell in love with the books she was carrying. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, why do you have all those books? And she said, oh, it's for my children's literature class. And I said, tell me about this class. Like, what do you take that class for? And she said, oh, I'm an elementary education major. And I mean, a light bulb just instantly like went on. I think within a week I had changed my major to elementary education. But yeah, it's all thanks to picture books that I became a teacher.
And in the best books, especially in the mid-century, I think you guys, we were living in the golden age of picture books. I really believe that. We were treated to some of the most sophisticated art in picture books that has ever been produced. Of course, we didn't know this as children. We have no idea.
I want to add to that. I think that those Parents Magazine press books were some of the best illustrated I have ever seen. I mean, I go back and they are works of art on every single page. Some are so intricate and the detail is amazing. And actually one of the books I remember, I'm going to hold it up, but it was called Mother, Mother, I Feel Sick, Send for the Doctor, Quick. I don't know if you all remember this, but it's all in shadows. So the whole book is done kind of like that.
I wonder if they're paper cutouts.
Well, and I agree with you, though, Carolyn, because my memories of picture books, like I said earlier, are really mostly tied to those Parents Magazine press books. Mm-hmm. And they're also really, they're such a time capsule. I still have a lot of them. And I've been going back and looking at the illustrations. And so if any of you know Never Tease a Weasel or Alexander the Horse, they're so, the color palette is so indicative of the late 60s.
Totally. I have a question for you. Did you have any books in your collection that featured children of color that wasn't The Snowy Day?
I don't remember that I did.
I don't either. I thought long and hard about that. And except for the Snowy Day, I did not.
So The Snowy Day broke ground in 1962 as one of the very first, one of, not the first, but one of the very first picture books to portray a realistic multicultural urban settings. So it was not the first book to feature Black children as the protagonist, but it was the first to win the Caldecott Medal, which is the award for the best picture book of the whole year. And even now, more than 50 years later, it is still one of just three Caldecott awards that feature contemporary African-American children as protagonists. There were lots of folk tales. Wow. There are fables. There are historical things. There are celebrating important people from our history. But just that everyday child who just happens to be a child of color, who is going about their day having a normal day, that is still a rarity.
Yeah, an experience we can all relate to.
Yes.
That is an experience that, yes, you know, we've all wanted to go out and play.
Mm-hmm. So at that time when The Snowy Day came out, I think they said like 6% of picture books featured people of color in it. But I never saw them. Nobody ever shared those books with me. All we got was The Snowy Day. Mm-mm. So something to think about, right?
So let's talk about some of the series books that we loved, like Dr. Seuss, Golden Books, Richard Scarry, you know, those types of books. I think Golden Books have a special place in people our age's hearts, for sure. Whether it's if we can remember going to the dime store and seeing them on the little spinner at the end of the aisle, and they were really accessible to us because they weren't that expensive. Mm-hmm. I have vivid memories of owning them, but also you always saw them, you still do, in doctor's offices, right? Or if you're a little kid and you're waiting at the dentist, Golden Books are everywhere. And there's just too many classic titles to list, really. I don't know about you guys, but my favorite and most of our society's favorite is the monster at the end of this book.
That was a Golden Book?
It's a little Golden Book, yeah.
I didn't know that was a Golden Book.
It is, yeah. And Grover still is my favorite Sesame Street character. And that book, you guys, still makes me laugh out loud to this day. I just reread it yesterday and I was just chuckling along, you know, when he's like, you turn the page. And I would read it aloud to my children all the time, when my girls, when they were little, and try to do my best Grover voice. But there's just so many classic little Golden Book titles.
Well, I liked, in terms of the little golden books, the Disney ones. So they would have Snow White and Cinderella and Peter Pan that whole collection. And that those were the little golden books that I loved to read.
Yeah. So what about Dr. Seuss books? Did you guys get into all of the different Dr. Seuss books?
Yeah, The Cat in the Hat. I was really worried about the ring in the bathtub. I didn't know what this ring was from and why they had
so much anxiety in this book.
It was a lot of anxiety. Yeah. And I didn't know.
Oh, I can't tell you.
I didn't know what it was. I didn't. And nobody, it's so funny. Adults don't know that we don't know what a ring in the bathtub is. I still don't exactly know what he was talking about, but it was this emergency that they had to get rid of the ring.
Okay, so what about Richard Scarry?
For boys, a lot of them, this was their entree into reading books. You know, stereotypical as it may be, it seems like girls weren't more able to sit down and listen to a story or read a story. It was Huckle Cat is over here and he needs to put gas in his car because he's going over here to the town where the baboon is getting into his banana mobile.
You got a lot of bang for your buck, I feel, with that, because I would sit down and play different games with it, like look for the little worm on every page and try to find it. Or, you know, how many vehicles are on this page and like try to count, like how many things with four wheels. So I kind of played games with it.
I'm Lowly Worm. God, I love that little worm.
I love that little worm.
And why did he have a little fedora on with the little feather? Isn't that funny that he chose to put a little hat?
He was fancy,
and then his belt. And he has a belt around his little waist. So funny. I love it.
We asked our followers on social media what some of their favorite picture book titles were. And you guys spoke. We received so many comments and titles of books, which is just more proof of the incredible and indelible impact these books had on all of us. So if you're listening and you contributed a title, listen fast, because I'm going to take a deep breath. You guys ready? Mr. Shaw's Ship Shape Shoe Shop, Tiki Tiki Tembo, We Help Daddy, The Surprise Doll, Madeline, Goodnight Little Bear, The Monster at the End of This Book, Where the Wild Things Are, Richard Scarry's Cars, Trucks, and Things That Go, Bedtime for Francis, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, Seven Chinese Brothers, Mr. Pine's Mixed Up Signs, Willie Bear, Donkey Donkey, Pokey Little Puppy, The Tawny Scrawny Lion, Blueberries for Sal, Drummer Hoff Fired It Off, Free to Be You and Me, Hope for the Flowers, We Like Kindergarten, The Diggingest Dog, Go Dog Go, The Saggy Baggy Elephant, Scruffy, The Tugboat, Tootie, The Lion and the Mouse, What Do People Do All Day, Where Did the Baby Go, The Cat in the Hat Dictionary, Little Red Hen, Pierre, Chicken Soup with Rice, The Ugly Duckling, The Little Engine That Could, Cat in the Hat, The Sheep of the Lal Bog, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, Miss Nelson is Missing, Bread and Jam for Francis, The Story of the 14 Bears, Robert the Red Rose Horse, If Everybody Did, Miss Susie, Frog and Toad, which each chapter is technically a standalone story, so we say it counts, Stuart Little, Pepito the Naughty Donkey, Happiness is a Warm Puppy, which is a Peanuts book, The Lonely Doll, Caps for Sale, Miss Twiggly's Tree, Harry the Dirty Dog, Sam and the Firefly, The Snowy Day, Betsy and the Vacuum Cleaner, Raggedy Ann and Andy, Are You My Mother, Put Me in the Zoo, The Boy Who Ate Flowers, Mr. Rabbit and the Lovely Present, Miss Nelson is Missing, Mike Mulligan and His Steam Shovel, Barba Papa, I had to say that one slow, Ferdinand, Puss in Boots, Curious George, not Puss in Boots, that would be gross, Puss in Boots, Curious George, Amelia Bedelia, Knight's Nice, Jennifer's Walk, Saggy Baggy Elephant, No Fighting, No Biting, The Big Tidy Up, and Babar. But thank you to everyone who sent us, who commented and participated. We love hearing what you have to say because so much of it is stuff we remember too.
Hey, listeners, it's Carolyn, and I wanted to check in. It's 2025, you guys. How's everybody feeling? Well, I know for me, sometimes all of these hormonal changes that many of us are going through can be a real pain. And while there are natural hormonal changes that are going on through our bodies, did you know that there are also more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living rent-free in our environment right now? Yes, disruptors that can affect actually how our hormones function. They're in our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, our skincare. And they all mess with our hormones. The good news is that we don't have to suffer through all of this anymore because now there's Hormone Harmony. And you've heard me talk about it. It's a formula made only with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. You've heard me talk about how that menopause-induced brain fog has really messed with me at times, but I've really noticed a difference since I've taken Hormone Harmony, and even my sleep habits have gotten better. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is truly dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means they only use science-backed ingredients ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality. And we are so excited to partner with Hormone Harmony. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code PCPS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code PCPS for 15% off today.
Hello, listeners. Today's episode is brought to you by Armoire, the clothing rental and return company that Carolyn and Michelle and I have been using for just a little over 6 months now. Armoire makes getting dressed easy and a lot more fun. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build a more exciting wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz, select items you like, and the clothes show up at your door in just 2 days. Then, when you're ready for something different, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. In the past, I've fallen victim to the fast fashion addiction. It truly is an addiction, grabbing that cute t-shirt off the rack as I walk by with my cart, because it's only $10. But we all know what happens. That $10 t-shirt goes in the giveaway pile 6 months later because it now looks like a dish rag. Armoire allows me to indulge in higher quality materials that look so much better, and they feel better too. Armoire also allows me to take some risks and maybe try out a style I wouldn't normally commit to, because I don't have to commit to it. I borrow it, try it out, see how I feel, and send it back. Right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/PCPS. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/PCPS to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again.
Okay, Blueberries for Sales by Robert McCloskey. That's definitely one of my favorites. And there's also a companion book about the same characters. It's Sal and her little sister, Jane. And it's called One Morning in Maine. And so I love these books so much when I was a kid. Then when I was on my honeymoon, we went to Maine for our honeymoon. And we found where Robert McCloskey lived. He lived in a place called Blue Hill, Maine. I know I did. And my husband is such a saint. We go to Blue Hill, Maine. And I'm like, look, this is where Sal and little Jane lived. And I go to the little bookstore. And of course, I rebuy books that I already have. And I bring them to the register. And the woman says, oh, would you like Bob to sign these for you? And I was like, what? What? Well, like, do you keep him in the back or something? Or how does this work? And she said... She said, yeah, I'll just bring him to his house. Just come back tomorrow. And so then we drove around the town trying to figure out which house was his. I'm a total stalker.
Oh, that's another reason I love you.
So we also asked some of our previous podcast guests, because they are all book lovers. And here are a few of their favorites. Amy Wineland Daughters, author of the incredible book, You Cannot Mess This Up, who we interviewed in an episode that aired last month and was the inspiration for our Day in the Life of a Fifth Grader episode as well, loved the Berenstain Bears picnic book because her dad always cracked up when he read it aloud to her. And it's, she said that's such a great memory.
Aww.
And for those of you that read You Cannot Mess This Up, I think that you know the special relationship that she had with her dad. And so I loved that memory from her.
So I talked to Martha, who was in our Dynamite episode. She is our benefactor, our Dynamite benefactor. And we talked to her about all of the quizzes that she filled out in her Dynamites in 1977. And so I just sent her a text saying, hey, Martha, we're just asking people about their favorite picture books when they were little. I swear to God, she turned around and texted me back in a fraction of a second. And it was like all caps, George and Martha, George and Martha. It was like the most urgent information she had to share with me. And she said, so George and Martha are the hippos that are the best of friends. And it's by James Marshall. And she said, James Marshall was a genius author. His stories about George and Martha's friendship and adventures were delightful and very funny. Our family still references these stories all the time. And I think that there is sort of a theme of family bonding to a lot of these things. This is something that she's still talking with her family about 50 years later. And then we heard from Colleen, who you heard from way, way back in our Judy Blume episode. And Colleen said, Tubby and the Pooh-Bah by Al Perkins. My dad always read it to me and my brother, and we were all assigned characters. I was Tubby the elephant. My dad was the great Pooh-Bah. My brother was Ami the young fish man. And my mom was given two small parts, the guard at the Dark Tower jail and the foodle fish. And to this day, her dad refers to himself as the great Pooh-Bah. Okay, so Where the Wild Things Are, I think we have to spend just a moment on Where the Wild Things Are because it's often considered the greatest picture book of all time. Of all the picture books ever published to this day and beyond, it is one of the best of all time. It was released in 1963 and won the Caldecott Award for the best picture book of the year, but it was not well received by adults, and it was regularly banned in schools and libraries.
What?
Because grown-ups did not. Yes, yes.
Why?
Grown-ups hated this book.
Was it too scary?
Because first they thought it was too scary. And because the little boy was naughty and he was disobedient and he was disrespectful to his mother. He yelled at his mom, actually. As my mom would say, he was sassy. There was sass talk. And people thought that this would be a bad influence on children. But what he was really doing, this is the marvel of Maurice Sendak, he was portraying for the very first time in picture books the real and true feelings of a child, mm-hmm. how a child would actually react in a real situation, which was revolutionary for the time. And in the early 60s, this began a movement called New Realism, where authors and illustrators were starting to portray childhood as it actually is, as opposed to how adults want it to be. So now, wouldn't you like to hear what our favorites are? Of course, we have favorites of our own, or we wouldn't be doing this episode at all. We've each chosen three that really made a big impact on us. But of course, that list changes by the minute. So whatever you hear, right, we can't say that these are our favorites. Mm-mm. We're just saying that these, and they're in no particular order.
Yeah.
These are just three books that were very important to us, and know that there are many more. And if you ask us tomorrow, the list will be different.
This is
Carolyn,
true.
Do you want to go first?
Yes. So thank you, Kristen, for acknowledging that this was a very difficult task to choose three. And yes, no doubt I would have a different answer tomorrow than I had yesterday. So the first one I'm going to share with you is really all about the memories associated with the experience of having the book read to me. And it was a book my mom read to me, and it was Tiki Tiki Timbo. That was published in 1968, and it was written by Arlene Mazel or Mazel, I'm not sure. It centers around two brothers. One was Chang, and the other was Tiki Tiki Timbo, No Saw Rembo, Cherry Berry Ruchi, Pip Berry Pimbo. That was the other brother. And all the problems that befall Tiki Tiki Timbo because of his long name. And Chang ends up being the hero of the story by saving his brother from a well that he had fallen down. And I want to, before I go on, acknowledge the fact that while the story is fun, it's not any kind of accurate portrayal of Chinese culture. That's kind of some of the topics that have come out about it now. A lot of Chinese Americans have said there's really no accuracy in the story, but acknowledge that it's a great opportunity to talk about why it's mm-hmm. not accurate, and to also recognize it's a good story and it's a folk tale, and a lot of those are very exaggerated. So with all that in mind, it's still one of my favorites because of my mom reading it to me. And as I've shared with you all, Lillian could kind of be serious a lot of the time. But when she read Tiki Tiki Timbo, she was a whole nother person. She just took on another personality. And I remember when she would say that really long name. And in the story, the little brother Chang has to run and tell people that his brother fell down the well. And he has to like run up a hill and he is out of breath. And my mom would just read that with such inflection and personality and be like, Tiki Timbo No Saw Rembo, Cherry Berry Ruchi, Pip Berry Pimbo. And I was just mesmerized by my mother reading that to me. And it would always make me laugh. And I just saw this kind of different side of her. She was like the greatest actress. I loved it.
That's so sweet.
That is
sweet.
So cute, Carolyn.
I love
it. And I love hearing that about your mom. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that. It's almost like a sonic memory that you have of her saying that really long name all out of breath. That's so funny.
Yes.
And it's also the acknowledgement of the stereotypical Chinese people in the book. There are a couple of books that fall into that same category. One that was mentioned in our list was The Seven Chinese Brothers, which I loved. The Seven Chinese Brothers. Everybody loved how that boy, like how his head got really big when he swallowed the whole ocean. The problem being, of course, that it was all of the portrayal of the Chinese people were based completely and utterly on stereotypes. But like you said, you can acknowledge your experience of it and understand why this is not an accurate portrayal of people. Michelle, do you have a pick?
I do. So my first pick today is Harry the Dirty Dog, which is a book written by Jean Zion and illustrated by Margaret Bloy Graham. And you know what? In 2007, they did an online poll. The National Education Association did an online poll and chose Harry the Dirty Dog as one of its teachers' top 100 books for children. Margaret Bloy Graham also wrote and illustrated these Benji's Doghouse books, the Benji books, which I loved the Benji books.
Oh,
and I
think
that's
why that book looks familiar to me.
Yeah, these Benji books are so, look at my little writing. The Benji books are amazing. And the illustrations look very similar to Harry because it's the same illustrator. But I loved Harry the Dirty Dog. And I remember thinking, just even as a small child, how clever that storyline was, that, you know, he's a white dog with black spots, but he doesn't want to take a bath and he buries his brush. He runs away. He has a grand time getting so dirty. And when he returns home as a black dog with white spots, his family doesn't recognize him and they think he's lost. And he keeps trying to tell them that, no, it's me. But all his attempts fail. And so he finally has to dig up the brush and make them give him a bath. And then they realize, oh, it's Harry all along. And I just thought it was so clever. And I think for me, what brings me back to books over and over again and what makes certain books, picture books, indelible in my memory is absolutely the characters and the illustrations, like we talked about earlier. But I loved the illustrations in Harry.
It was just so clever. I mean, I remember being just thrilled by this notion that he was a black dog with white spots now. And no, I'm really a white dog with black spots. I just thought that was the cleverest thing.
All right, Kristen, you're up.
Okay, my turn. When I was 5, I got my tonsils out and I went to the hospital and I got a lot of presents, mostly books. I got stacks and stacks of books, including Ira Sleeps Over, about a little boy who waffles back and forth about whether or not he should take his teddy bear when he sleeps over at his friend Reggie's house. I got Curious George Goes. These are not my picks, by the way. It's just like a
It's just Kristen's way of getting
books.
Extra titles in.
That's right.
Right? Yep. I'm so sneaky. Curious George Goes to the Hospital, which is famous for one particular image where Curious George is getting a shot and he's holding his arm out and there's a needle coming at his arm and his mouth is big with fear. I love that picture.
I was just going to say, I wonder how many kids got that book when they got tonsillectomies in the 70s. That just seems like...
All of them.
All
of them.
Any kid got that one.
The same way every new brother or new
Everybody
sister
got
the Berenstain Bears have a baby.
Yeah. Yep, totally. So I also got a set of 3 books about a little badger named Francis, one of which included a 7-inch, 45 RPM record that told the story. And the voice of Francis is seared in my memory from listening to this book, because I could sit in my room and I could essentially read this book to myself by listening to the record. And so I had to track this down and I won it on eBay. It's going to be arriving today. Because
oh
I needed
gosh.
To hear Francis's voice again. I know, I'm like looking out my window, like, are they here yet? Are they here?
You're gonna cry when you hear it. I bet you cry.
I know. I am. I'm going to cry when I hear her little voice.
Please
when
video
I hear Francis's
it.
Voice.
Put a video.
Okay,
your
I will.
Camera up. Okay.
So for these purposes, I'm going to choose Bedtime for Francis, which is the story of a little badger who's having a little trouble going to bed. And it was published in 1960, written by Russell Hoban and illustrated by Garth Williams, who also did all the illustrations for Little House on the Prairie. Now, later on in the series, by the time you get to Bread and Jam for Francis, Lillian Hoban is doing the illustrations instead of Garth Williams. And the whole internet wants to know why. Oh, Carolyn, do you know why?
Oh, no, I'm going back just to remind everyone about Garth Williams. Mm-hmm. Remember our little fun fact? We know that he was John Sebastian's godfather.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, we can take that out. But
didn't he do the illustrations for Charlotte's Web, or is that someone else?
Yeah, Charlotte's Web and Little House on the Prairie.
He did.
And Francis.
And Stuart Little. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Francis. Okay. So why bedtime for Francis? Because I was Francis. I was that little badger. I did not want to go to bed, and I would scheme reasons to get out of bed every single night and bother my parents while they were watching like Barnaby Jones or Mary Hartman. So Frances in this book gets up repeatedly, just like I do, and she asks to watch TV with her parents. She says she forgot to brush her teeth. She asks for some cake. She asks to get into bed with her parents. Remember when you used to ask to sleep with your parents? Can I sleep with you? Can I sleep with you? And her parents are annoyed, but they're also very calmly resigned to the situation, just like my parents were. And when she goes to tell her parents that there's a tiger in her room, they say, "Well, did he bite you?" And she says, "No." And they say, "Well, then he is a friendly tiger." And her parents don't use adult logic. This is the brilliance mm-hmm. of the book. Mm-hmm. Instead, they honor Frances and her fears, which were my fears. Father can even turn a conversation about the wind blowing her curtains, which she's very frightened of, into a discussion about everyone has a job.
"If the wind does not blow the curtains, he will be out of a job. If I do not go to the office, I will be out of a job. And if you do not go to sleep now, do you know what will happen to you?"
"I will be out of a job," said Francis.
"No," said Father.
"I will get a spanking," said Francis.
"Right," said Father.
"Good night," said Francis. And she went back to her room.
And I just think that is the most brilliant passage I think ever written in any book ever. So most famously, Frances is known for her little songs about life. And one of the main reasons that I needed my eBay purchase, this little 45 record, is because on the record, they actually sing those songs. Whereas when you read the book, you just have to read it like a poem. They don't give you a tune. You don't know what the tune is.
I sang them when I read them aloud.
And did you just make up your own tune, right? So I needed to hear Frances sing the alphabet song from Bedtime for Frances, in which she says, "U is for underwear down in the dryer."
"S is for sailboat, T is for tiger, U is for underwear down in the dryer."
I just thought it was so funny that she said underwear.
Underwear.
Oh, yes. Underwear.
So, Kristen, it sounds like a lot of the reasons you loved the Frances books are similar to why I made my next selection. So this book I chose because of the story. The book is called The Grown-Up Day. It's also from our friends at Parents Magazine Press. And it's written by Jack Kent. And he also does the illustrations. The reason I find it similar to your reasoning, Kristen, is this was, I think, the first time I saw myself in a book that I could say, "Me too." So this is a story about a brother and sister who basically play dress up for the day, and our mom and dad and the, you know, their stuffed animals are their children, and they kind of go through this day and play. And then at the end, they're with their mom tucked in bed and they'll get to grow up the next day. And I remember thinking, like, I play like that too. My stuffed animals are my babies. I put them in strollers. I feed them. I talk to them. And honestly, I think it was the first time in my reading lifetime that I experienced that me too feeling that I still love to this day in a book when I can see myself in a character and realize, oh, I'm not alone. There are other people out there that do this same thing. And there's something so special and cathartic about that, that that is why I chose The Grown-Up Day. And every time I see this cover and look at these pictures, I get that feeling right in my soul. All right, Michelle.
Okay, so my number two pick for today is The Giant Jam Sandwich by Janet Burroway and illustrated by John Vernon Lloyd. This book was published in 1972. And for those of you that remember it, this is a super fun, it's a pretty short rhyming story where Itching Down, the town, is infested with wasps and they create a giant jam sandwich to trap them. And I will say that this was a little bit of a departure for me illustration-wise because the illustrations were kind of scary to me. I'm showing Carolyn and Kristen some of the illustrations. Wasps. And just the people, it's very distinct. But the rhyming text was so clever. Like, then Bap the baker leaped to his feet and cried, "What do wasps like to eat? Strawberry jam. Now, wait a minute. If we made a giant sandwich, we could trap them in it." You know, it's all just very clever. So they have to make like an entire like warehouse full of dough, and they create an oven, and then they have to bring all the bread has to come out on giant carts that's tied down with huge ropes. And I just thought it was so clever, and it was such a departure from what I usually read, that it is so memorable to me. And I actually would read this one even when I was an older reader. I would pull this one out of my bookshelves a lot just because I thought the story was so different and so unique. And it was really original. I didn't have a lot of other stories that I loved that were quite like it.
So this was a book that was in your home.
Oh, yeah. This is my copy right here from when I was a child. Okay, Kristen, what's your second pick?
Okay, my second pick is Corduroy, which was published in 1968. It's by Don Freeman. And this Corduroy has provided both me and my husband with a lifetime of lines to use at the mall. For instance, when we find ourselves on an escalator, we will say, "This must be a mountain. I've always wanted to climb a mountain." And it's so awesome that Mike knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'll be the one who's like, "This must be a mountain." But Corduroy takes place in a department store, the kind we went to as kids. You know, it was very fancy. Mm-hmm. It was an upscale experience to go to the department store downtown. And it's the story of a stuffed bear who longs for someone to buy him and take him home. And the store is always filled with shoppers, but no one ever seems to want a small bear in green overalls. But when Lisa asks her mother to buy him, her mother says, and I can hear my mother saying these words, "Not today, dear. I've spent too much already. Besides, he doesn't look new. He's lost the button to one of his straps." And there's nothing profound about that line whatsoever. I only read it because I can hear my mother saying it. So there's that memory part of it that's wrapped up, right? So this, of course, sends Corduroy. He doesn't know he's missing a button on his overalls. And this sends him on a middle of the night quest to find a new button, where he climbs a mountain, AKA an escalator, and he finds himself in a palace, AKA the furniture department. And I know these pictures by heart. It's like every stroke of the pen is drawn onto my own brain. Mm-hmm. I know his furry ears. I know the night watchman coming down the escalator with his flashlight. Even the hairband that is in Lisa's hair, I have it all memorized. And even though the main character is an anthropomorphized bear, it's still part of the New Realism movement because it's showing a slice of childhood as it really is because of Lisa. So Lisa is, you know, she's the supporting character. Corduroy is the star, but Lisa is the supporting character. And she's just a little girl shopping with her mom who says, "No, you can't have Corduroy." And she goes home and she counts her money in her piggy bank and she goes back to the store to get that damn bear. So Ruman Alam, who was a novelist, he just wrote a book called Leaving the World Behind, which will soon be coming to Netflix. There will be a Netflix series soon. And he wrote this about Corduroy in Slate magazine. "Lisa, the human protagonist of Don Freeman's 1968 classic Corduroy, is someone I think of as akin to Peter from The Snowy Day. Her blackness is never in question, even as it is beside the point. She saves her money for the toy she wants and brings it home with her. End of story." Which made me ask the question, this is so embarrassing, did I know she was black?
I was just going to ask that question.
I was just thinking same thing.
I wasn't
going to say that out loud.
I was neither.
I know. Did I know? And so I've done a lot of ruminating about this because, like I said, the illustrations are seared into my mind. So clearly I have a good picture of who she is. And what I have figured out, this is not about being colorblind. It's not like, well, I didn't see race when I was a child. That's not what this is. It's because at that young age, I did not know about race. Nobody had explained race to me. Nobody talked about race ever. And I processed her the way that I saw her. She had black hair and she had brown skin, but I didn't know to categorize her. Because nobody ever talked about that, I didn't know. Yeah, see, there she is. And he makes that into an argument for, we're not ignoring her identity. But he said, all children and the adults who are reading to them would benefit from more kids like Peter and Lisa, kids of color, as the heroes of utterly quotidian stories, mm-hmm. where we're not talking about their race. Such children are a paltry fraction of the body of literature for children. Within the genre, the everyman, the default hero, when it's not a talking animal or a sentient toy, is almost always a white child.
Again, getting back to that point we talked about before, and to see yourself as a child in these stories, how sad, for lack of a better word, it was that a lot of children could not see themselves doing these everyday things, and how important that was for me, and to think, gosh, they missed out on that moment that I just described to you. That was indelible to me.
That's
when
exactly
I
right.
said me too.
Yeah.
That's really sad.
Yeah.
My last one is... the book that I chose because of the language and the words. I honestly think if I look back now, my love of writing and the dance that words can do started with this book. And this would be Mr. Shaw's Shipshape Shoe Shop. This was, again, Parents Magazine Press, 1970, written by Eve Titus, and the illustrations were by Larry Ross. And the illustrations are very intense. And there's so much alliteration and assonance, which, of course, at the time, I had no idea what that was. But now looking back and listening, it was just, it was lyrical. It didn't rhyme like a lot of other ones, but yet there was this melody to it. And I'll read you just the first two sentences. Mr. Sylvester Shaw was the best shoemaker in town. His shop was in an old building on an old street between Mr. Brown's bakery and Mr. Green's grocery. And the whole book goes on like that. His cat is named Shoo Shoo. And the story is about Mr. Shaw, who is an older gentleman, has a shoe shop in the seaside town, a ship port. And he, his building, he finds out, is getting condemned and it's going to have to get knocked down. And he's very sad about the destiny of the shoe shop. And you'll have to read the book to find out what happens to the shoe shop. But let's just say it involves a ship. And the ship's captain.
Of course it does.
Yes. And Shoo Shoo. But it, honestly, I used it as a sixth grade teacher to talk about all those pieces of figurative language that I just mentioned to you. Mm-hmm. I showed the kids, we read that book, and just how we can use language, not only to tell the story, but to do it in such a way that it's such a pleasure to listen to. And that is why mm-hmm. I chose Mr. Shaw's Shipshape Shoe Shop as my third favorite choice.
Okay, so my last pick is Santa Mouse by Michael Brown and illustrated by Elfrieda DeWitt. It's published in 1966. And you guys, I don't know Christmas without Santa Mouse because of this book, and neither do my mm-hmm. own children. And I know this book was part of the Christmases of many of our society members as well, because last Christmas I posted a picture of this book on Instagram and a lot of people went crazy sharing their own memories of this mm-hmm. book by Michael Brown. I don't think there's a Christmas in my life up until 52 that I haven't read this book at Christmas time. The past few years, I've just read it by myself because either my kids aren't home or they're not interested. I'm like, who wants to hear Santa Mouse? And everybody's like, meh. I can recite most of this book pretty much the first sentence, I can just recite the whole book without even looking at the words. The sweet illustrations absolutely are tattooed on my brain and embedded in my soul. I feel like, it's something that's so much a part of my childhood and just my whole life. And in our family, we took this book very literally and believed Santa Mouse was actually Santa's little helper. So just like the book tells you to do, we left out cheese every year for Santa Mouse. And in return, Santa Mouse left us, and then when I had children, left my girls, a little tiny gift.
Okay, Kristen, what's your final pick?
Okay, so the final pick, lastly, is the book that I traveled across the country to experience in person at the museum in Massachusetts. That book is The Little House by Virginia Lee Burton, published in 1942. It's the story of a little house in the country on a hill full of daisies who, over time and because of encroaching modernity, She eventually finds herself surrounded by big, tall skyscrapers and streets full of honking horns and pollution. If you remember, like, the pages get all gray, the air gets all black, until someone buys the little house and puts her on a flatbed truck and moves her out into the country and onto a brand new hill full of daisies. And so the Cape Ann Museum in Gloucester, Massachusetts, was the museum that was holding this exhibit. The reason being, that is where Virginia Lee Burton, the author and the illustrator, was from. So I come to the exhibit, and I turn the corner into the exhibit, and I see the original drawings. I get my first glimpse of the original drawings, and I see the replica of the little house standing in the middle of the room, and I had to bite my cheek so I wouldn't cry. It was a very immediate and emotional response. And I really surprised myself. I was like, why am I crying? I'm crying.
It's because that image is just, like I said about Santa Mouse, those images, it's embedded in your soul. I mean, it's not just an illustration. It represents so much more.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. It really speaks to the importance of the visual image in those book, that artwork. Mm-hmm. You don't waste your time on shitty artwork, because these images are going to live in our hearts forever, right? So there were also, in this exhibit, they also had original drawings from her other books, including Mike Mulligan and Katie and the Big Snow. And when you see what is essentially a napkin doodle of a steam shovel that would become Marianne from Mike Mulligan, because Marianne is the name of the steam shovel. We always think Mike Mulligan is the steam shovel, but no, Mike Mulligan is the boy who runs Marianne's steam shovel. When you see this little napkin doodle, it makes you cry. It literally makes you cry. And so I'm snapping pictures of Marianne for Liam, and I'm snapping pictures of Katie and the Big Snow for Mike, because he loved Katie and the Big Snow. The pictures of these characters, they're like long-lost relatives. You're like reuniting with people. That's what it felt like. It felt like reuniting with people. Wow. So Virginia Lee Burton was from this area of Gloucester called Folly Cove, which is just as beautiful as it sounds. It's very idyllic. It's very Murder, She Wrote. And she formed a collective of women in this area. And she taught these women printmaking. That's how she made her illustrations. She was a printmaker. And they had a big workshop in someone's barn with printmaking machines, and she taught them artistic techniques. And eventually, these women became so good that they created a line of textiles, like home textiles, cloth napkins, tablecloths, dish towels, and things like that. And you could find them in big department stores. And when you look at these textiles, you can see that they had been honing a style that looks just like the illustrations from The Little House. And so, of course, these things are collector's items now, and there are people who just rabidly try and track them down. But they're not very available. They didn't mass produce at all. Most of them are in the archives of this museum in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Well, I'm so grateful that we still have access to these books, many of which are still available in bookstores, which is incredible considering how fleeting and disposable a lot of our fads are today, right? A lot of the media that we consume is gone so fast. And if they're not available, well, thank God we have eBay, right? I'm looking out my window waiting for my eBay purchase to arrive. Thank you all for listening today. And thanks also to our mothers and our teachers and our librarians and our grandmas and Colleen's dad, the great Poobah, for sharing these books with us and giving us what are apparently some real lifelong memories, and unknowingly giving us our earliest exposure to fine art.
And join us next time when you'll be the hosts of the show. We asked you what you wanted to know about us and our Gen X lives, and we'll be answering your questions in the PCPS's first Gen X themed Town Hall Forum.
We hope you feel inspired to post about your own favorite picture book from your childhood. And if you do, make sure to tag us so we can be part of the fun. And please make sure you are following our podcast where you listen. It makes a huge difference in if we get heard. And like, review, rate, and share with your friends. We appreciate all your support so, so much.
We really do.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of our Santa Monica buddies, Jack Tripper, Janet Wood, and Chrissy Snow, to good times.
To happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. Information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to me, the Crushologist, and Carolyn and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, I guess there's always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded at Modern Well, a woman-centered co-working space in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.
We get a happy feeling when we're singing a song.